And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and my guest today is Elizabeth McKenzie, who is a respected novelist, having already published the novel and stories Stop That Girl, and the novels McGregor Tells the World, and new in paperback, The Portable Veblen, which was named to the long list for the National Book Award and shortlisted for the 2016 Bailey's Prize. Elizabeth, despite the title, The Portable Veblen, this is a novel and not a primer on the sociologist Thorstein Veblen.
That is correct, Steve.
But since our Veblen, who is a young woman, 30 years old, living in Palo Alto, shares a name with Thorstein, she does feel an affinity toward him.
She definitely does. Her mother raised her kind of in the tradition of Veblen. I mean, it's anti-consumer. Her mother was also doing her PhD on Veblen, but didn't finish it. Ostensibly, that's why she named her Veblen. They share their values and sort of a outsider status. You know, Veblen grew up in kind of an isolated situation. So, you know, I think she identifies with Veblen in a lot of ways.
And she admires him so much that she does translations for like a Norwegian society in America.
Absolutely, yeah. On her father's side, she is Norwegian and she doesn't know that much about it because he won't talk about it. And it's like she got a crush on a language, which is something that's happened to me.
And so which language did you crush on?
Well, you know, first it was French, then it was Italian, and then lately it's been Japanese. So.
And you can see a multitude of languages in the back of the book.
Yeah.
On the cover of the book is a little red squirrel, although the squirrels in the book are gray squirrels, Western grays, aren't they?
Yes, yes. But when you get to the end of the book, maybe you'll understand the significance of the red one.
Yeah. As you mentioned, her father's Norwegian. Her last name is Amundsen, is that last name because with Roald Amundsen discovering the South Pole, that as soon as her mom and her father meet, everything goes south.
Oh, my God. That's a great connection. Yes, that's quite so. Thank you for noticing that.
Was that intentional on your part?
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
So the opening chapter of the book is called In the Attachment. And in it, Veblen and her boyfriend, Paul Vreeland, become engaged. And boy, does that sound ominous to say, yeah. Here we come together, engaged in the attachment.
Well, you know, in the first chapter, you find out that it's kind of the squirrel kind of believes he has this secret power to end the attachment of leaves to branches. Like he takes responsibility for causing winter. But yeah, there's kind of like a residue of that sentiment that kind of makes you wonder what's going to happen with the engagement.
Late in the book, you note that in that area, there are quite a few times where the leaves persist on the trees until spring.
Right.
And so it's almost like the squirrel hasn't been doing his job.
Yeah, that's true. Well, they do it differently in California. Everybody has their own style.
Also thinking about in the attachment is thinking about how Paul and Veblen relate to their parents. And they have not been able to extricate themselves from their parents' influence.
No, they have not. Paul feels like he has, basically, but anytime he comes in contact with his family, he just starts sparking, just can't deal with them and can't deal with, you know, his brother. Veblen, on the other hand, can fit in with her mother and stepfather when she's home, but is very reluctant to have anybody else meet them.
Well, let's look at all the parents. We have Veblen's mother, and that's Melanie, and she is a narcissistic hypochondriac.
Okay. I thought she was kind of normal, actually, when I was writing the book, but everybody keeps telling me she's a narcissist. I guess the hypochondriac I knew, but yeah.
So when we look at the way Veblen approaches the world, it's always because of this trying to placate her mother. And I think it's really damaged the way she asserts her sense of self in the world.
You're right. I think she doesn't really know who she is yet. I think that there is this time in our lives. I mean, maybe it's not like this for everybody, but it was for me. When I left home, and I took a long time to figure out, I mean, everything I had done had been in reaction to my family. So it's sort of like, you know, a plant that grows at some weird angle because there was something, you know, blocking it or something. I was just molded a certain way that without that to react to anymore, I didn't, like, what's the point of growing sideways if the thing in your way isn't there anymore? So you have to kind of figure out who you are. And I think maybe one way or another it happens for everybody. But
well, since you were always kind of living in reaction to your family, when did you want to become a writer?
I kind of always liked writing because, I mean, I just grew up with these sort of very bossy, noisy, larger-than-life people who were very bewildering to me. And so, like, privately, I'd be writing down my thoughts, you know, in my journal or something, not necessarily against them, but just sort of trying to figure things out on my own like I couldn't think when I was around them or something, you know, without realizing it, I was turning into a writer.
So you're kind of like Schopenhauer. You couldn't think with noisy people around, and you drew conclusions from that.
Yes, me and Schopenhauer, yes.
Also, we learned that Paul's parents are from Humboldt County. And of course, with Humboldt, being Alexander von Humboldt, the great naturalist and botanist, his parents are also naturalists and botanists as well.
Yeah. Now, that's something I hadn't thought of before. Yes. Well, that area is famous for its botanists, I'm sure you've heard.
One of the weed capitals of the world. Right. Marijuana has grown there, and much violence has been there in the past.
That's quite so, yes.
But Paul has reacted against them strongly, and he tries to be a more mainstream person. In fact, he's kind of Torstein Veblen's worst nightmare,
right.
Consumerist.
Exactly. I mean, gradually Veblen starts seeing how much these things mean to him. He wants to get a boat, for God's sake. I mean, what a what a monster. Yeah, he just can't help it. It was too much when he was growing up. And I think his parents even start to realize that they may have done him wrong a little bit. So
very early on, they're walking. You mention the name brand, the labels of the clothing that he's wearing. And whenever an author starts to name brands, I always perk up and go, okay, what are they trying to reveal about their character? So why did you choose those particular brands?
Well, you know, that was very hard for me to decide to do that in the beginning because it's like on the first page, I think. And I was just trying to describe how he dresses in contrast to Veblen, because Veblen kind of basically buys clothes at thrift stores, or her mother buys them for her, or she just cuts things up and sews them together or whatever. And he's got all the, you know, the hip name brands. And I mean, part of me was cringing at putting those names right in the first page of the book, but it had to be done.
Also, there's a seam ripper that's part of the story. And just that concept of that very expensive seam ripper just fascinated me.
I love that you said that no one else has mentioned the seam ripper. Well, that actually is a little autobiographical detail. Yeah, but my mother was obsessed with this seam ripper she got me when I used to sew. And she'd always check on it. Like you know, she'd call me and want to know if it was okay, like had I lost it or, you know, I don't know. It was very strange. She was very particular about her tools, like her scissors had to be in a certain place. And if you ever borrowed them and didn't put them back, you know, and her seam ripper. And anyway, I don't know what that means.
But a place for everything, yeah. Everything in its place.
Yeah.
But of course, it just now hit me that her mother has given her the tool of the end of their own relationship, because that seam ripper rends the garments separate from each other,
oh
the pieces
God.
Separate from each other. So like the destruction of the family, the separation of the family is held up in that seam ripper.
Oh my God. Yeah, you're right. She's given her the potential to kind of cut loose.
Now, why is it important that the squirrel is handsome? Couldn't he have just been an average looking squirrel?
Well, I think beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and who knows what this squirrel really looked like? I mean, he might have been quite dowdy, but to her, he's handsome. So
Melanie's husband is Veblen's stepfather.
Right.
And his name is Linus. And he seems to be a very kind and patient man, but also I would say, wouldn't you think that's enabling?
Yes. Yes, maybe a bit. I mean, I'm very partial to that character. And some review said, and kindly Linus, you know, just they also used the word kind. And it made me so happy that someone gave Linus his due, because he's always in the background. But I'm very fond of him. And, you know, he's not perfect. Maybe he did some enabling, but he's a good guy.
Well, I start to wonder about his character and why he's attracted to Melanie and why he would put up with behavior that so many people wouldn't put up with.
Like what in particular?
Well, we learn a little bit more about Melanie's background and like her mother kind of being an awful person in her own right. And we learn about Paul's father's background and with his uncle dying in Vietnam. So we can kind of see how their parents are shaped and then how that shapes the way they shape their children. But Linus is a bit of a cipher, and we don't know why he is willing to undertake such a project as Melanie.
Well, good. Yeah. I mean, it's like different textures in the book, and maybe it's good to have one character that, you know, you can't necessarily, it's a mystery why they're the way they are.
And on Paul's side, I think his mother is probably the most sympathetic character as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I like them. I like all the characters in their way, but I can see why you'd say that. Yeah, I guess Bill, if he was really your father, he could be hard, but I like him anyway.
Well, and he's kind,
yeah.
And he's a very patient person in dealing with a lot of people, with Paul's brother, Justin, who has developmental disabilities, also dealing with Veblen's father later on. He's very patient with him. But that's one of the roots of Paul's problems with his parents, is that he's so understanding toward his brother that it doesn't allow Paul to be his own person.
Right. Yeah. He feels that, I mean, I think what getting together with Veblen makes him realize is that he does have to deal with his, I mean, I hate using these kind of catchphrases, but his family baggage. And maybe up till now, he's just avoided it.
And you share that dislike of catchphrases with Veblen's mother.
You're right. Yeah. Yeah, she's always cracking down when Veblen says anything that sounds like it could be from TV or something like that.
And so do you generally have a distaste for cliches that permeate our culture?
I do, kind of. I guess I do. I mean, I'm sure I use them anyway, but, like there's this one everybody says lately, like, I'm so over it or something like that. And I'm like, stop saying that. You're just saying that because you heard everybody else say that, you know, but I mean, I say cool and I say all kinds of stuff everybody says. So I don't know what it's all about.
Well, at the end of the day, yeah. That's what it is.
Yeah. It's a mystery.
So there are a lot of facts about squirrels.
Yes.
The book.
Yes. There's a lot to know about squirrels.
What was the most interesting thing about squirrels that didn't make it into the book?
Oh, wow. That's such a good question because there's a lot that didn't make it in. For instance, I didn't realize that until recently that squirrels make mushroom jerky. They really do. They harvest mushrooms. They lay them out on the branches of a tree to dry out, and then they gather them up and store them away. Isn't that fascinating?
No. Well, the squirrel migrations I'd never heard of before, and that was just fascinating.
Well, that is in the book, and that's something that I didn't know about either. But when you start looking into it, there's so much about it. I mean, Lewis and Clark wrote about it in their journals, and there was this place in southern Illinois where 450 million squirrels ran through this one area. That's almost half a billion. It was like a river that ran for several days, solid squirrels. And I guess, you know, some people at first thought it was, you know, to do with food supply. But what was really fascinating to me about it is that they've actually discovered that it wasn't about a food supply. It was just, they all just decided to go. There was plenty of food where they came from and where they went. So
just a guy screams road trip and
yeah,
on.
Exactly.
I went online to do some reading about squirrel migrations, and there was one in 68.
Yes.
On the East Coast.
Yes.
And I found this paper about it. And this guy was talking about the squirrel migration of 68. I mean, he'd gone to North Carolina. But in that process, he mentioned the Smithsonian Institution Center for Short-Lived Phenomenon, which was active from 1968 to 1975. And they would study things like this, or when it would rain fish.
Okay.
Or volcanic activities. And I just thought that was such a great idea, the Center for Short-Lived Phenomenon.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, there is a whole section at the Smithsonian dedicated just to squirrel studies itself, but I hadn't known about that.
So Veblen mentions, you know, squirrels are the only wild mammals that live in proximity toward humans. Is that why you became fascinated with them originally? Or
That's exactly it. I mean, I'm sitting in my office day after day, but if I turn my head and look out the window, I can see wild animals. I feel like we should be honored that these are wild animals that are willing to live near us.
Or do you think they're just stupid enough to live near us?
They've adapted. I think they're, you know, thriving. Everywhere I go, people want to talk about squirrels.
About 10 years ago, some students at Harvard went squirrel fishing. They were just sitting on the quad there and had noticed a few phenomena. One of them was if a squirrel has an acorn in hand and you throw another acorn, or if it has a peanut in hand, if someone's been feeding them peanuts, and you throw another peanut in their proximity, they will drop what they have to go get the new peanut or acorn. But they also found that once they hold on to that, they'll hold on to it. So they would tie fishing line around a peanut, throw it out, and then they could lift the squirrels off the ground, clutching that peanut. Wow. So you could go fishing for squirrels, literally.
Oh my gosh. I don't know. That doesn't make them look very dignified. I don't know if I approve of that.
But that would mean they're more like us.
Mm. That's true.
And their similarity to us is maybe what's attractive.
That's true. In a way, that's part of one thing going on in the novel is that, you know, we all have romantic visions of the other. We want the other to be better than us. We want our fiancé to be perfect, you know, and then gradually we find out they're no better than us, or that things aren't romantic. They're just what they are.
And that's something that strikes Veblen very early on after this engagement. She starts, you know, having a mini freak out in her head. And what are the things she's worried about now that she might be attached to this person for the rest of her life?
I mean, it starts small. She starts worrying she'll never be able to have corn again because Paul doesn't like corn on the cob, and he thinks it's pasty, and she thinks that's ridiculous. And how could he not like corn? And they'll never be able to go to corn stands together. And, you know, she realizes that Korn will disappear from her life because of this. And she doesn't agree with what he wants to do with the squirrel. And, you know, it just goes on and on. I mean, when you start realizing that the person isn't just a cut out of you. So it's a lot to face.
So this handsome little squirrel has been living in the attic, and yes. He's been making a lot of ruckus.
Yes.
And Paul is not enamored with him, and in fact has great feelings of antipathy toward him.
Yes.
And I thought it was nice that we got to see later on why his particular disliking of squirrels was explained.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, yeah.
That's not useful at all. But I think in viewing his relationship with his brother and his parents, Justin, that it explains his poor feelings toward the squirrel, because he sees Veblen having these attachments to the squirrel and making concessions for the squirrel that his parents would make for his brother.
I do feel like, you know, you start to realize that there's a lot of things, little thorns in his side, and that are making him act kind of squirrely. And when you start to understand where they come from, I think he becomes a lot more sympathetic.
So do you think Veblen loves him in part because he's kind of squirrely?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I mean, she's spent her whole life embracing her mother, who's very difficult and very problematic and maybe hard for other people to love. So she should be able to love anybody, right? So Paul just shouldn't have to be perfect. But maybe there's this part in her that just was kind of hoping she could catch a break and get some, you know, have someone around who wasn't so much work.
Well, and she's working in her own regard, as we all are.
Right, yeah. How so?
Well, with her inability to allow someone to be contrary, to have negative feelings about something, she automatically feels like she has to be kind of the devil's advocate in that situation.
That's right. Yeah, that could be hard. Yeah.
When she said, is it so important to share a negative feeling? I can't remember what the exact quote
right.
is. But sometimes as a partner, you just want support.
Right, exactly.
And understanding.
Exactly, yeah.
And if she can't give that, then
yeah,
that's a need being unmet.
That's true, yeah. No, she has a lot to learn, you're right.
As we all do. Now, Veblen didn't finish college and is working in as a temp on the Stanford campus, going through office to office, essentially, helping out in the medical school area. So many of us kind of define ourselves by our careers and what we do for a living. Why do you think Veblen really hasn't felt that kind of pressure to do that?
One of the things you get out of reading Thorsten Veblen is that there's something to be said for thinking more about how we spend our time than how we spend money. And I think Veblen is kind of, you know, at an early age, decided she's not going to be on this. I mean, John Kenneth Galbraith described the squirrel wheel that we're all on, where we work to spend. And she's kind of, since she doesn't spend because she was trained that way from an early age, except for her, you know, basic needs, she can kind of do things that aren't necessarily so career oriented and then have fun with the stuff she really enjoys, like the Norwegian translation. And, you know, just as an aside, Thorsten Veblen, he had a very spotty academic career. He'd get teaching positions because everybody thought he was so brilliant, but then he wasn't a very good teacher. I mean, he'd post for his office hours like 12:30 to 12:35. And I guess he mumbled. And I mean, he had his devotees who, you know, thought he was wonderful, but he wasn't a practical person to have on the faculty. Yeah. So he was working for fun on a Norwegian translation. On an Icelandic translation of one of the great sagas called the Laxdala Saga. He spent 25 years working on it, and it was just for fun. But I guess I really relate to that kind of mentality because I work on two literary magazines just because I like doing it.
Well, what part of working on the journals do you like so much? What is it that excites you about it?
I just love getting the manuscripts, seeing what people have sent, you know, finding something I really like, finding out maybe the person's never been published before, telling them they're going to be in the magazine. I even like the production of the magazine and doing the readings, having the people come to the bookstore. I mean, just the whole thing I enjoy.
You're able to look past the getting kind of like all the imitators out there of young writers who are imitating their favorite writers. And you're going, oh, this is, you know, Adam Johnson, and this is George Saunders. And
yeah, no, it's, I mean, I've been doing that for a long time. I started at the Atlantic Monthly as assistant to the fiction editor and just got really hooked on reading manuscripts. So
recently I've been kind of obsessing on this idea of narrative. And of course, you know, that's what have we been talking about for 8,000 years in civilization, but narratives. But I've kind of been thinking about how they're bad for us. We're always trying to tell ourselves that, you know, narrative, you know, stories are important in our lives. I'm just trying to be contrary, I guess, at this point. I'm trying to think on how narratives aren't helpful for us.
Can you say why?
Well, because they're always untrue. Because the second anyone starts to tell a story, it's a lie.
Well, my way of looking at it, especially with fiction, is that, you know, you're metaphorically getting at truth everywhere you turn. And, you know, it's like with a dream, when you have a dream and it really hits home, it really, you feel something really strongly from it. It didn't happen really, but it echoes some very real thing that you do understand. And I think that's what fiction does. I think it, you know, great for seeing into other people's heads, empathizing with them, you know. So I think there's a lot of truth in fiction, actually.
Well, there is, but is what we're taking from it the right thing? Because, you know, when those things do resonate with us, are they resonating with something that's true, or are they resonating with some need that we have, and that it's, you know, it feels like scratching a wound that itches, but it's not good to scratch that. It needs to heal on its own. And that resonance, is it merely just stimulating things that need to be fixed as opposed to a true resonance?
Well, I actually started the book as an anti-war novel. I mean, I started it back making notes for it in 2006 and, you know, was reacting to stuff going on at the time in Iraq and stuff and Afghanistan and, you know, was close to someone in a clinical trial that was kind of being used by as a statistic. I don't know. So there was like some very dark stuff, you know, at the root of this that it, you know, I felt like I was going to expose in a satirical way. So it wasn't so much an avoidance, you know, working on this novel. There was a lot of really grim stuff I was dealing with when I was writing it.
And clinical trials are a big part of the book because Paul is trying to create a new piece of equipment to help battlefield medics deal with swelling in the brain. Was there a particular item you came along that inspired that idea?
I knew I wanted Paul to have invented something. And I was also really interested in brain injury. And, you know, there was a lot going on in that field at that time. And I mean, there still is. So there are some things like that in existence. I mean, there are little saws that, you know, for doing craniectomies and craniotomies and stuff. But there wasn't anything that, I mean, the whole idea is that the sooner you perform the surgery, the better the outcome. And so that's how, I mean, I actually came up with this idea that there could be this one on the, that they could use on the field, like a cookie cutter, basically. But I mean, I read a ton of stuff about military injuries and medics and, you know, got the sense that this could actually be something medics could use. You didn't have to be a surgeon to use it. And
it's another way to end the attachment.
Right.
So that also made me think of trepanning.
Yeah, exactly.
In ancient cultures.
Exactly. Yeah. That's how he pitches it, in fact, you know, in Washington. When he goes back.
And it seems like maybe Veblen's father, Rudger, maybe in ancient Norwegian cultures would have been a candidate for trepanning.
Right.
To let the foul spirits out. Because her father has suffered with mental illness his adult life. And Melanie kind of uses that as a cudgel against Veblen. With the threat of her possibly being insane like her father, she uses that to cow Veblen into behavior that she approves of.
You're right. She does. Yeah. Someone told me that everybody in this book has brain damage. And I mean, I don't know if that's true, but.
Well, the philosopher, Joe Bob Briggs, he used to review drive-in movies, popular critic back in the 80s and 90s, said, "We're all damaged, every one of us."
Yeah.
So is there a larger point to take away, or are we just experiencing these set of people's lives? Is there something particular about the human condition you're trying to say?
I want people to know more about Thorsten Veblen. I think he's incredibly relevant now. I think that it's kind of, I don't know if that many people think about the dark underbelly of medical research, but that's a place to go in this book. I think it's definitely worth thinking more about squirrels. So, you know, take your pick.
So where do you think you fall short if Veblen were looking at your life?
Oh God, that's such a good question. I have a dishwasher. He used to do all of his dishes in a bathtub. We'd wait till the whole bathtub was full.
Well, that's not very sanitary.
I don't let skunks in the house. I guess he actually let them wander in and out. And I do have some furniture that isn't handmade. So.
Was it in this book that you're talking about the arts and crafts movement?
Oh, decadent aestheticism.
Yeah,
he scorned it. I mean, he used to admire Morris because Morris also translated the Laxdala Saga, and he thought maybe he was a kindred spirit, went and visited him, and was disgusted.
Because that is a paradox.
Yeah.
You know, in order to create beautiful things, there needs to be some type of capital involved in it, whether it's the luxury of time to get that done or a luxury of money.
Right, exactly. His most prized possession, Thorsten Veblen's, was a knife his father had made by hand, and it was very plain, but it was very good.
So most of these characters we can be sympathetic with, but there's one that pops up in the book that we're just pretty much asked to ridicule, and that's Cloris Hutmacher.
Oh, good, yeah. Well, she's a meanie. I agree with you there.
Why are we allowed to not be sympathetic toward her? Because I'm sure being the daughter of a huge industrialist didn't serve her well in her life.
Well, you're right, but it's really fun to have a villain in a story, so she's the one.
Also in the book are several photographs dispersed throughout the text, and it's unusual to have photographs in a novel, especially so they seem a bit random on which ones were chosen. For example, there's a picture of a bag of old dirty clothes.
Ugly.
Sorry. And see, thus proving, you know, the fallibility of my memory and thinking process to boot. Because I'm trying to think on what ties these. And I was actually going through and going, okay, here's this picture. Okay, here's the picture of the guns. Okay, the picture of Evelyn makes sense, of course. And going through and the picture of the burrito near the end of the book. And I'm going, I'm too stupid to figure out why these are here.
Well, you know, there was a review of the book in the New York Times by Jennifer Senior, and she said that the pictures have a narrative arc all their own, and I'm dying to write her and ask her what she thinks it is.
So what was the inspiration, the reason, and what effect were you going for?
Well, it started out, I was working on the novel so long, I just started sticking them in, like decorating the walls of a room or something that I was trapped in. Then I grew fond of them there, and then they sort of seemed like they belonged. And I thought when I sent it out, my agent didn't seem to mind, and then she just sent it out with the pictures too. And I thought any minute someone's going to tell me to take them out, which would make total sense, but they didn't.
Well, and there is some variation in the typesetting. So some stuff like it's been typewritten, mm-hmm. and some things look like press releases or whatever. So there's not a uniformity in the look of the text throughout. I mean, is that something that you had to fight for or that the publisher was resistant against?
No, I mean, there are different kind of texts interwoven through the book. So just whatever was appropriate, if it was something she typed on her typewriter, we tried to make it look like it was from a typewriter. If it something from a brochure, like a product description, we tried to make it look like a brochure.
Well, Elizabeth, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and putting up with me.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. This was a great conversation.
Elizabeth McKenzie is the author of the novel, The Portable Veblen, which is now available in paperback from Penguin. I'm Stephen Usury, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.